We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. This morning, we'll explore what historians David Kivig and Myron Marty call nearby history. We'll talk about how we can delve into the stories of our families and communities in order to better understand the past and the present. Kivig and Marty say with a little guidance, literate people of any age and background who possess reasonable amounts of curiosity, judgment, and persistence can master most historical research techniques. We can learn to, as our guests put it, think historically. Myron Marty and David Kivig have put together that guidance in their book, Nearby History, Exploring the Past Around You. The book is now in its third edition. The first edition went to press in 1982. For close to three decades now, it has been used by professionally trained and self-taught historians. Listeners, you're invited to join us with your questions and comments by telephone or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. And the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Myron Marty is Professor Emeritus and Dean of Arts and Sciences Emeritus at Drake University, and he's here with me in the studio. David Kivig is Distinguished Research Professor Emeritus in the History Department at Northern Illinois University, and he joins us by telephone. David Kivig, welcome. How are you?
It's good to be with you. I'm no longer in Northern Illinois, where I spent 11 happy years, but I've moved to Washington, D.C., where there's a pretty good neighborhood library that I continue to use.
That would be the Library of Congress?
It's five blocks away, and I enjoy it as much as I can.
Well, it's very good to talk with you this morning. And Myron Marty here in the studio with me. Welcome back to Focus.
Thank you.
Well, the first chapter of Nearby History begins with some words from Henry Ford. History is more or less bunk. But you also include this from Ford. The farther you look back, the farther you can see ahead. What was Henry Ford's view of history, Myron Marty?
Well, it's ironic that he would say history is bunk and he would collect all the artifacts from the past that show up at the Greenfield Village. That statement may be taken out of context, but it surely caught on. A lot of people use it. I've had students tell me that, that history is bunk, but they change their minds before the end of the semester. That's about what I know about Henry Ford on it.
Yeah. I would imagine, though.
David may know more.
I would imagine, though, that you would both agree with his statement that the farther you look back, the farther you can see ahead.
Sort of. Indeed. That's the important statement to take away from Henry Ford, who said history is more or less bunk when he was on the witness stand in a lawsuit that was fairly perilous for him in 1919, but the measure of Henry Ford is that he assembled this huge outdoor museum at Dearborn, Michigan, where his original auto plant was. And he tried to bring together the memories of ordinary people. His criticism of history was a criticism of what he saw as an elite history that focused on things that didn't matter to ordinary people, and he wanted the everyday life of ordinary people brought to the same level.
Hmm. It's interesting that one of the things you advise us to do when we're looking for our history is to look for not only the big events, the manifest events, but also the latent events, the things that are present but maybe less visible. Would you offer us a couple of examples?
Well, in doing family history, you may focus on the genealogy of it, and you miss the things that happened that shaped the family. And that's what I would call latent events. You know, there might have been a family that grew up with the children not aware of the fact that along the way, another child had been born and didn't live. I would call that a latent event. When they make that discovery, they have a new view of their family.
And I think also the genealogist who looks just at the family tree sometimes misses events in the community and in the larger culture that compel the family to move or migrate or suffer a period of economic hardship or encourage them to expand the size of the family because of the prosperity they're enjoying. Those are the connections between the life of an individual family and the life of the larger society that when we started this project, we perceived that people who were very interested in their own genealogy and doing wonderful work to uncover it were sometimes overlooking to give a fuller picture of their family.
I think it's very interesting that in the book Nearby History to Guide Us, you advise us to look at family relationships, physical characteristics of our families, location and movement, family economics, daily living, education, and more. There's not a question in that, but... But,
well, that was very much what we were trying to do, and it's good to know that we achieved our objective of putting our advice in terms that people who weren't professional historians could understand.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about it is that we didn't know each other until we met at a historical conference, and then the next year we shook hands and agreed to write a book on family history. That came out in 1978, and we discovered in doing that family history was a whole lot more than genealogy, and that we could help people who wanted to do a whole lot more by expanding into this book.
As amateurs, how far can we go in our investigations of the histories of our families and communities?
Of our family?
Yeah, and communities, and where we live.
Sometimes surprising things happen. My brother sent me, he didn't know the source of it, a genealogy of my mother's background all the way back to about 1600. My mother always felt that she was German, and my grandfather was Swiss. Her parents were German. She always felt that when we talked about our Swiss heritage, we were ignoring hers. I wish I could show her this now. That came from a website I tracked it down to ancestors.com, or ancestry, I think it is, .com. But what our goal here was to help people connect what we call the particular with the universal. Academic historians do the big picture, you know, the universal things. And Historians of the nearby past tend to do family, neighborhoods, institutions in their neighborhood, organizations, individuals that are not part of their family, those sorts of things. And that's what we're aiming to help them do here.
Hmm. You mentioned online resources. What else is out there? There are all kinds of sources. Let's go to David Kivik, and maybe you would tick off some of the things that we could look for. Once we have some questions in hand, where do we go to look for the answers to those questions?
Well, we find lots of material that's useful in the collection of published works in our library and other libraries. We find a great deal of material in archives. I worked at the National Archives for a year, so must give them a plug, because they have a huge amount of material relating to individuals, military pension records, census records, all the World War I draft cards are held in the regional archives of the National Archives in Atlanta, Georgia. And the archivists there can help find an individual draft registration document. But there are also plenty of local archives that may contain records having to do with a family or certainly with a community. And beyond that, they have amazing collections of photographs. We plundered several state archives for some of the photographs in nearby history, and accompanied them with the commentary that might suggest how useful photographic evidence can be. The cover photograph comes from the Minnesota Historical Society, and other photographs come from the Ohio Historical Society and other repositories. We also find local newspapers enormously helpful in doing community research. And Mike has written the chapters about the use of artifacts, and so I ought to let him make mention of those.
Well, your question was about what you can find on the web that's useful in doing family history. One of our appendices deals with that, shows how you can find genealogical information, information on immigration, emigration, naturalization records, vital records, and you can also find some of that in the state archives. One of the things that's most helpful is simply having access to university, what used to be card catalogs online. I used that a great deal to track down things in the University of Illinois Library. And people can find things about their families there, perhaps, and about their communities. It takes a little bit of initiative and imagination, but it can be done.
How can we use artifacts to uncover nearby history?
Well, come to my house and I'll show you. This is the first piece of furniture that my father bought, a bookcase, stands in our entryway. There is the rocker that was given him by the Ladies' Aid Society of this congregation where he taught in the school. There is One of my favorite pictures in this book, I didn't mark it, but it is, we had the postcard that showed the couple on it and the photograph. And then our Shirley's mother gave us a beautifully framed picture of the same couple with everything touched up on it, you know, press the man's pants, button the coat, straighten the tie. That was long before photoshopping. And from that you can get stories. You can learn, there's a picture of my mother-in-law when she was about a year old sitting in a rocker with her older brother dominating over her on a tricycle. And that domination, I think, continued their whole life.
Their whole lives. Very interesting.
So there's some insights into family history just from that.
This is Focus. We're talking today with Myron Mike Marty and David Kivik about their book, Nearby History, Exploring the Past Around You, the book now in its third edition. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk with a listener now. This is someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to put a plug in for a couple of things. One is our local archives at the Urbana Free Library has a great genealogical collection, and I hadn't realized all the treasures they have there. In addition to access to internet databases like Ancestry, they have a library subscription, so if somebody's just getting started, they can, and they don't want to invest in a subscription themselves, they can go to the archives and use the computers there. But someone listening somewhere else may have another local library where they can access those databases online. But I found the town where my great-grandmother came from in Ireland because I was walking along the shelves in the archives and I saw a book of listing of townlands in Ireland in the 1850s. And I had a recollection from my grandmother that her mother had come from Rathorn, Rathaspe, County Meath, and I had not been able to find it on any map or on anything I could access. And I was looking through this, and I figured out, well, you know, this woman had an Irish accent, and my grandmother learned the name of the town when she was a little girl and told it to me when I was a little girl, and now I'm in my, you know, the second half of my life, and I thought, you know, this memory might have evolved. So I looked at the listings from that point of view and figured Rath couldn't change all that much. And sure enough, I found Rath means fort. I eventually found the town, and I found it was actually Rathowen in Rathaspic Parish in County Westmeath, which was pretty good, I think. Yeah. But another thing that I have discovered in using the Internet for genealogy is that you can often find other researchers who are looking for people who overlap with yours, and you can share and discover mutual resources. I was recently checking on some distant relatives of my husband's because I have a family Bible, and I was entering that information, and I wanted to double-check on something. And I found that somebody else had corrected the ancestry index for the census record of a particular census for this person. The name wasn't quite right. You can also change, you can also give maiden name information, for instance, or other names that the person went by. And I was able to then send a message to this person through Ancestry. They don't list the email addresses, but I was able to send a message through Ancestry. And we've been having this great correspondence and sharing information that fills in the other person's whatever they have. I've also been able to share photographs with people that I've found this way, because people often sent their photographs to their distant relatives. Or if they were at a family gathering, you know, if you have a big family reunion, you take a picture of the whole group, and then you take a picture of individual family groups. Well, I had a picture of a small group, and it turned out it was four, it looked like a four-generation photograph of males. And it turned out that it was a small group photo from a bigger gathering. And when I found, I ran into somebody else online who was researching that family, and together we were able to identify people and share photographs digitally. So thanks a bunch.
Well, thanks for the call. There's a lot of information there.
Well, I think what's wonderful is that terrific story started in a local library, and a local library is a wonderful starting place, not only for learning about the family, but for learning about the community in which that part of the family lived.
Hmm. How do you judge the veracity of source material?
That's a tricky question. As the caller was speaking, I was reminded of the experience of a professor at the University of Washington who was so intrigued by the stories his Irish immigrant mother told about growing up, you know, where there had been a fire, where she'd gone to school. He was so intrigued by that that he went to Ireland with her to view the places that she was describing. He discovered that most of the things she was describing happened before she was born. She was simply relating it from stories that she had heard. So you need to do some validation to the fullest extent that you can. People don't think of themselves as being dishonest, but exaggeration is part of a natural instinct, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I come from a family of great storytellers, and you kind of wonder, you know, have we embroidered on what happened, or have we made it, you know, is it totally a matter of one's imagination? It made a good story.
One of the things that we bring from the academic side of our perception of this whole matter is that if you can find multiple sources of information that intersect on a particular story, you have a much higher degree of reliability than if you're dependent upon a single source. The business of stories changing as they're repeated is certainly a common experience. But if you can find a contemporary document, whether it's a newspaper story or a personal letter or a photograph that confirms the basic story, you can have a much higher degree of confidence that the story is accurate.
Hmm. Mike Marty mentioned a little bit earlier about the two photos, one being touched up, you know, the tie was straightened and the pants were pressed. So how do you read a photo? How do you, you know, get into a photograph?
It was a lot. That was a rare one. It's getting harder because there's so much, you know, you see the cover of Newsweek of Obama and Reagan standing together on it, and that didn't happen. There are ways. I have a nephew who tells me that he can identify any picture that has been photoshopped. He's a photographer. And you can look for clues in it. There are certain lines that don't really come together the way they should. I'd like to go back a bit to the how do you know what's true? Mm-hmm. The best thing to do is to go to documents. And I happen to live in a family of historians. I have all of my dad's date books, which he treated as diaries from when he graduated in college in 1920 till he died in 1963. And I have all of my mother's daily diaries from 1949 till she died in 1982. So we can look things up there. And my brother and sister and I have been writing family letters about every other week. We used to call them fortnightlies, but we slip up on that a little bit now. But I have a complete collection of the letters that I've written since 1972 and of my brother and sister during those years, and of letters that our children wrote when they were in college. So if they tell us a story about what happened in college, we can look it up.
Hmm. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Robinson on line 4. Good morning.
Good morning. I have done a lot of genealogy, and I'd like to offer a couple of tips. First, it would behoove a good genealogist to become familiar with women's costumes. I can't tell you how many times I have found a photograph in a published, let's say, book or county history, misdated, which you could easily tell by the fact that the women were not wearing the clothes that they should have been at that period. And there are books in the libraries that give you pictures of what costumes were in 1860 versus 1870, 1880, 1890, whatever. Another good tip for a beginning genealogist is when you do find an obituary of an ancestor, it may not tell you who the man was the son of. The thing to do in that case is to go to his siblings and chase down their marriages and their obituaries, because one of his sisters may very well note in her obituary that she was the daughter of so-and-so, giving you thus the maiden name of the mother. And as to artifacts, my own family had a man who left us a tool, a steel tool shaped rather like a trowel, but with a blade-like working part that none of us knew what it was until I, searching his life, discovered that he had been a tanner in Ohio, and thus the tool turned out to be what you could call a flensing tool for scraping the fat off the hide before it was tanned.
Mm.
That's just a lot of the many things you can find out in local newspapers. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Comments?
Well, that was a wonderful insight. It suggests that imagination and exploring alternative ways of getting to your goal are a part of the process. And learning about the community and what went on in the community can, as in the case of this Ohio tanning equipment, can tell you a lot about the family, but also the reverse is true. Learning about the family can help you gather insight into the larger community, and we find that can be very worthwhile for people who may not have as much information about their individual family. They didn't keep every letter the way the Marty family did, but they can gather a sense that helps them understand their family by exploring what the communities that their family lived in were like.
Mm.
What we envision is that many people start doing local history with genealogy, but we hope that they will go beyond genealogy to family history, putting some flesh and bones on the names that are shown on the genealogy charts. And we hope that they will go from that to looking into their community's history, the organizations of the community, the schools, the police department, and things like that. Those are the particulars of history, and that's what nearby historians generally focus on. But the farther you go with it, the more you're drawn into the larger picture.
Yeah. Now, we're seeing results of the census that was taken last year. Big headline on the paper yesterday in Champaign-Urbana was about how the county has grown and how we've become more diverse in the last 10 years. How can we use census information to learn about nearby history? I gave one example. What else can we learn?
Well,
go ahead, David.
The United States Census, which has been taken ever since 1790, gradually expanded to gather information that would help the Congress understand the needs of the American public. And by 1850, they were taking information on family circumstances, economic circumstances, where people had come from, and a whole variety of information that is available through the census records up to, well, now we're about to get the 1940 census fully open. The Census Bureau keeps the census closed for 72 years so that the privacy of living people, or 99% of the population living at a particular time, at least would not be interfered with. But one can go back and learn from the raw census records, not only the circumstances of individuals, but what the whole community looks like in terms of occupations, in terms of wealth, and look in the 1920 or 30 census and see what a small portion of the population had refrigerators, and look at what the educational levels were, and it's a marvelous source of a great variety of information. You mentioned the ethnicity of the current Urbana community. You can certainly use the same census information to understand what the mix of populations was at a previous era.
And now going back to 1940 and beyond, is all that information, all that data, is that available online now, all of it?
I don't believe it is it, David?
I don't think so, no. I think you have to go to either the National Archives or one of the regional branches of the National Archives. There's one in the southwest suburbs of Chicago for Illinois and the surrounding area. But also the manuscript census is available on microfilm, and some local libraries have at least purchased the microfilm from the National Archives for the immediate area. That's the state of the art as I understand it.
Yeah, okay. This is Focus, and this morning we're talking with historians David Kaivig and Myron Mike Marty about Nearby History. That's the title of a book they wrote nearly 30 years ago, Nearby History, Exploring the Past Around You. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call this morning or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-333. 3333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And we've gotten a question in by email that's a very good one. Do your guests have any suggestions for getting elderly parents to sit down and record information about their lives, family history, and family heirlooms for their children? I have gleaned bits here and there, but my parents live 800 miles away, and there's never enough time when we visit for me to really quiz them.
Well, that's where oral history comes in. I had a student once, I made an oral history assignment where students were to interview their grandparents if they had anything, had some living near them. And one person came up to me and says, I can't do that. He says, Pop won't talk. Mm. And I said, well, give it a try. Tell him it's a school assignment. You have to do it. And he opened up with his military experiences, described his military experiences. And when the tape ran out, this young man said, Gramps said, come back. Mm-hmm. And so when he came back, he had gone up to the attic and dug out a collection of things that he had kept from his military service, a gun and his uniform and hat and papers, all of that. And they couldn't shut him up. So you have to have an opening. Usually, often a photograph will help get it going, or an artifact, you know.
Yes.
Where did you get this unique knife, mm-hmm. or this old-fashioned mixing bowl, mm-hmm. That's been handed down? That's one way to do it. Good
Those
luck to this
call. Those are great suggestions. The one thing I would say, when you're particularly when you're dealing with elderly informants, is not to push the interview too far in terms of time. About all that most people can really concentrate on is an hour and an hour and a or an hour and a half, and it's much better to leave the interview incomplete and come back maybe even the next day and try and do another session.
The reason for doing that is that they will often say, oh, I thought of something I should have told you yesterday, mm-hmm. but I'll tell you that now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a suggestion from our technical director, Kyle Mabry, that the listener might check out StoryCorps, the website for StoryCorps. It has starter pages for formulating questions, mm-hmm. and thinking about what you want to know, and then being, you know, somewhat prepared before you, you know, sit down with someone and have that conversation.
Preparation for an oral history interview is absolutely essential.
And I can also say that in Nearby History, there's a lot of questions also that are very helpful, mm-hmm. in that regard. So what do you say we take another call? This is a listener,
sure.
in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. Another tip of sorts. I used to teach a writing course in college, and one of the things that we asked people to do was interview a relative about, and we give them a topic. And we found that interviewing their parents about the Great Depression was too traumatic. The parents wouldn't open up on it, but the grandparents would. So that's just a tip that if something was very painful, you may find that going back a generation or getting a sibling or something like that to interview may be helpful.
That's a great tip. Thank
yeah.
you. Thank you very much. Anything else that comes to mind in terms of getting people to open up about the past?
Photographs, mm-hmm. documents.
Letters.
Letters, whatever you can find there. Also, if you, elderly people might be afraid of, now people use digital recorders, Many still use tape recorders. Many elderly people are intimidated by them. And so if you sit down and talk with them and just visit with them and have it turned on and then play it back to them and they'll hear their voice on it, they'll say, that doesn't sound like me. Mm. But you say, well, that is you. You're talking there. I found that to be an effective way to get it going.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Decatur on line one. Good morning.
Yes, I've got a couple of tips. I've been looking to determine exactly when my great-grandfather immigrated to the U.S. He came from a place in Germany called Alsenberg, which doesn't exist. And so I'm trying to nail down exactly where he came from. So I went to back in the 70s, and then I repeated it again, as it turns out, yesterday. I went down to the Recorder of Deeds downtown and got the original property purchase. So the property was purchased in 1847, so I know exactly that he was here in 1847. So when I look at the ship manifest, I'm going to be looking from 1844 to 47. Also, trying to trace back where in Germany he immigrated from, he settled in Boudy, Illinois, so I have contacted a number of other German families that immigrated from Germany at the same time, saying, okay, where were your relatives coming from Germany, to see if there were any connections back that way. And in doing so, I've uncovered some genealogy for those families as well. So it all ties together, and again, it kind of fits in with your developing a history, the whole thing, tying families immigrating and the circumstances that they're coming over and family history and so forth. So thanks.
Thank you for the call this morning. You know, I was thinking, you know, today we're talking about photographs and correspondence. Today we have so much of that. We have email. We have photos everywhere. Can you give us some tips in terms of keeping that organized, preserving it, conserving it?
The hard thing with digital photography is that it's so easy. It's not always so easy to download it, but when you do download it, you have such a proliferation, you don't know which ones you want to keep. And back to the days of film photography, if you took a picture and paid for the processing of it, you didn't want to throw it away, even if it wasn't any good. And so probably the first thing you should do is to go through your photo collection and decide, is this a good photograph? Does it tell any kind of a story? And then don't need to throw the others away. Just put them in the box marked culled out or something like that. That would be one way of going about it, I think. But you're right. There is such an abundance that it's hard to know what to pick out of it.
Yeah.
I think photographs sometimes contain information that the photographer wasn't even intending be included in the photograph. And it's one of the nice things about the chapter in Nearby History on Photography, which I can boast about because Mike wrote it. And I didn't have anything to do with it, is the tips that it gives for looking at photographs and searching them for clues that the photographer wasn't intending be a part of the photograph, thinking about the frame of the photograph and what's just beyond the focus of the photographer. Or we have one example in that chapter of the reflection in the mirror behind the people being photographed being the most interesting thing about that particular photograph. It was actually a photograph taken in the 1930s by a photographer who had a specially built camera where the lens actually came out of the side of the camera. So he set up his wife as his accomplice, and they would go to streets in the Midwest, in Ohio in this particular case, and he would make a fuss of showing, of setting up to take a photograph of his wife, but actually what he was doing was taking a photograph of bystanders watching this whole operation take place. And in the photograph we found, his reflection in the plate glass window behind two observers shows the whole operation. So the details of photographs can be fascinating.
Yeah. And the photographer was the artist Ben Shawn, and recently a book, a collection of his photographs from that time was published, and it's very interesting, and now I'm going to go back and look at that after having reading visual documents, the story in this chapter, and taking a closer look at those photographs and what they tell us, what they can reveal about that time. And I do believe most of them were taken in Ohio.
Yes, as a part of a WPA project. A Farm Security Administration project that Ben Shawn worked for. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Sometimes you see things that are very revealing about a family and the context in which they lived. One that I think is in our collection, shows a large family lined up just to sow, and a horse at one place and a dog on the positioned also. It was clearly a very posed thing, and you can tell from that what they thought was important and what the relationships were of the people that they were posing.
I thought the photograph that you included, and I don't think it's in visual documents, I don't think it's in that chapter, but there's a wonderful photograph of I think they're streetcar workers, and
yeah.
the men. And you can get a sense. There it is.
There it is. Yeah.
You can get a sense of the relationships between them. And if I'm recalling correctly, there's one fellow who doesn't have quite the same dress on. You know, the same uniform on. So I was wondering what when you look at that, what do you see?
Well, you can see the one who's he's either has white socks on or he's wearing long underwear that hangs down, or what we used to call spats. That happens to be my wife's grandfather, and that's where we got the picture.
Oh.
But you can see how the different ways in which they pose, some looking right at the camera, some looking to the side, not knowing what to do with their hands. You'd like to know something about the priority by which they were lined up, or whether it just you go wherever you want to go.
Yeah. Well, we're coming down on time, and before we have to wrap up, I want to ask you, okay, so we've set out with a set of questions, and we've found some answers, and we want to put what we've learned down in narrative form. Advice for putting what we've learned together in a written account.
I'm in an OLLI class, and I just told my seatmate there yesterday, who's doing some oral history, that he wants to convert it into a story. We have one little section that says that the four elements of every good story are origins, milestones, dynamics, and character. If you get those things into any story, you'll have a good story. There are more that you can put in, but, you know, that dynamics, how do they make decisions? Character, what sets them apart from others? Milestones is the natural, you know, weddings and funerals and that. And origins is a natural also. How'd this thing get started? I've told everything you need to know to write a good story.
Okay, we're primed and ready to go. And finally, one last question. The material that we might come across, whether it be artifacts, visual documents, correspondence, records, if we're going through a relative's home, let's say, after a death, and we can't absorb all that material, what should we do with it?
Well, I would say offering it to a local archives or library is an act of generosity to the community that will eventually find ways to make use of that material in the further exploration of life in that community.
I can give an example if we have time for
sure.
It. My mother-in-law was a seamstress, and she made dresses for my wife, who was very small. And they have these very small dresses, and she has some of them. And we don't know what to do with them. I don't know that our kids will have it. So I talked to somebody at the Missouri Historical Society. She was born in St. Louis. And I said, would you have use for something like that? He said, would we ever? Mm-hmm. We'd love to have that. We don't have any trouble getting garments of every age from adults. But something from the 1930s about it, a child dress homemade, we would really jump at it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us this morning here on Focus. David Kivik, thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you.
And Myron Marty, thank you.
A pleasure here also. And we thank you for the thoroughness of your preparation for this interview.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure. David Kivik and Myron Marty are the authors of Nearby History, Exploring the Past. Around You, the book now in its third edition.